some TV dramas can be very gripping, compelling. Some of you maybe watched things like The Night Manager, was on last year, or Line of Duty just a wee while ago there. And there's plenty of drama in them. You'll hear people talking about them in work or wondering what's going to happen next, as if there were people actually listening to real events happening. And we can't wait for the next episode to come along. Well, there's plenty of drama in Paul's last few years, as recorded by Luke. I can't promise that the sermons will be as exciting as the episodes of these programmes, although Aaron will do a couple of them, so they'll probably be all right. But come along and see what's happening to Paul in the last few chapters of Acts. In fact, I'd really encourage you to read right through Acts. We're at chapter 23, not very many more chapters. Read up to chapter 28 and see how Paul's life unravels over these last number of chapters of this book. We're going to find out a wee bit more today. And we'll just, until the end of June, we're going to be following through Acts as we see the last episode in Paul's life. Let's just put ourselves back in the picture again. Paul, after three missionary ventures mainly around Asia Minor, he's returned to Jerusalem, and he's been warned that there will be trouble waiting for him there in Jerusalem, but nonetheless, he goes to Jerusalem. And we saw last week how a number of Jewish people saw Paul in the temple area with some Gentiles, and they thought that he had invited them into the temple courts, which he hadn't. They were mistaken in that. But a whole lynch mob gathered, and Paul had to be rescued by the Roman commander, Claudius Lysias. And the commander couldn't get any sense out of the mob. They were shouting one thing and another. So he called them together. He called the Sanhedrin together and wanted to try and find out what is happening. And that's what we're going to read today. We're going to start at the end of chapter 22. We'll read chapter 23. I just want to read it because the narrative almost speaks for itself. And then we'll just share a few thoughts together that we can learn from Paul. So let's read from chapter 22 of Acts, beginning at verse 30. The next day, since the commander wanted to find out exactly why Paul was being accused by the Jews, he released him and ordered the chief priests and all the Sanhedrin to assemble. Then he brought Paul and had him stand before them. Excuse me. Paul looked straight at the Sanhedrin and said, "My brothers, I have fulfilled my duty to God in all conscience to this day." At this, the high priest Ananias ordered those standing near Paul to strike him in the mouth. Then Paul said to him, "God will strike you, you whitewashed wall. You sit there to judge me according to the law, yet you yourself violate the law by commanding that I be struck." Those who were standing near Paul said, "You dare to insult God's high priest." Paul replied, "Brothers, I didn't realize that he was the high priest, for it is written, 'Do not speak evil about the ruler of your people.'" Then Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others were Pharisees, called out in the Sanhedrin, "My brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. I stand on trial because of my hope in the resurrection of the dead." When he said this, a dispute broke out between the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and the assembly was divided. The Sadducees say that there is no resurrection, and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. There was a great uproar, and some of the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, stood up and argued vigorously. "We find nothing wrong with this man," they said. "What if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him?" The dispute became so violent that the commander was afraid Paul would be torn to pieces by them. He ordered the troops to go down and take him away from them by force and bring him into the barracks. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." The next morning, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound themselves with an oath not to eat or drink until they had killed Paul. More than 40 men were involved in this plot. They went to the chief priests and elders and said, "We have taken a solemn oath not to eat anything until we have killed Paul. Now then, you and the Sanhedrin petition the commander to bring him before you on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about his case. We are ready to kill him before he gets there." But when the son of Paul's sister heard of this plot, he went into the barracks and told Paul. Then Paul called one of the centurions and said, "Take this young man to the commander. He has something to tell him." So he took him to the commander. The centurion said, "Paul the prisoner sent for me and asked me to bring this young man to you because he has something to tell you." The commander took the young man by the hand, drew him aside and asked, "What is it you want to tell me?" He said, "The Jews have agreed to ask you to bring Paul before the Sanhedrin tomorrow on the pretext of wanting more accurate information about him. Don't give in to them, because more than 40 of them are waiting in ambush for him. They have taken an oath not to eat or drink until they have killed him. They are ready now, waiting for your consent to their request." The commander dismissed the young man and cautioned him, "Don't tell anyone that you've reported this to me." Then he called two of his centurions and ordered them, "Get ready a detachment of 200 soldiers, 70 horsemen and 200 spearmen to go to Caesarea at 9 tonight. Provide mounts for Paul so that he may be taken safely to Governor Felix." He wrote a letter as follows: "Claudius Lysias, to His Excellency Governor Felix, greetings. This man was seized by the Jews and they were about to kill him, but I came with my troops and rescued him, for I had learned that he is a Roman citizen." Bit mischievous there, as you know, if you remember the truth of the incident. Anyway, "I wanted to know why they were accusing him, so I brought him to their Sanhedrin. I found that the accusation had to do with questions about their law, but there was no charge against him that deserved death or imprisonment. When I was informed of a plot to be carried out against the man, I sent him to you at once. I also ordered his accusers to present to you their case against him." So the soldiers, carrying out their orders, took Paul with them during the night and brought him as far as Antipatris. The next day they let the cavalry go on with him while they returned to the barracks. When the cavalry arrived in Caesarea, they delivered the letter to the governor and handed Paul over to him. The governor read the letter and asked what province he was from. Learning that he was from Cilicia, he said, "I will hear your case when your accusers get here." Then he ordered that Paul be kept under guard in Herod's palace. Now, quite a lot of narrative there, obviously, and it sort of speaks for itself. Good stories, interesting stories. You can read those in any book and you think, it's a good tale, I'm going to read this. But what can we learn from these verses this morning? I just want to suggest very briefly four simple lessons that we can learn. Paul sets us a real example here. He courageously follows Jesus. Luke points out many similarities. If you read Luke's Gospel and then read Acts, which is really Luke's second volume, you see all sorts of similarities between what happened to Jesus in Jerusalem and what happened to Paul. They both set out for Jerusalem knowing that trouble awaited them. They were rejected by their own people. They were arrested without cause. They were unjustly accused by false witnesses. They both were slapped in the face in court. They both were victims of secret Jewish plots. They both heard the crowd calling for their deaths. And they both were then subjected to a 5-stage trial. In each case, Jesus by Annas, then by the Sanhedrin, then by Pilate, and then Herod, and then Pilate again. Paul was tried by the crowd, the mob who convicted him right at the start. Then he was tried by the Sanhedrin, then by Herod Agrippa, then by Governors Felix and then Festus. They both went through this whole series of events very, very similarly as Luke records for us. Do you remember the words of Jesus? Jesus said, "As the Father sent me, so I am sending you." And he said, "If anyone would come after me, he must take up his cross daily and follow me." And he said, "All men will hate you because of me. If the world hates you, keep in mind that it hated me first. They will treat you this way because of my name." Paul hadn't read those verses, of course, that the Gospels were just being written during these years. But Paul was following in the footsteps of Jesus. He was following Jesus, whatever the cost. Paul gave up everything to follow Jesus. We know, reading his letter to Philippians chapter 3, verses 7 and 8. "Whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss compared to the surpassing greatness of knowing Christ my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them rubbish, that I may gain Christ and be found in him." So here was Paul, the great Pharisee, one of the leaders, who could have been one of the real leaders of the Jewish faith, saying, "All that went before is nothing to me compared to following Jesus." I wonder, is that true of us? I wonder, is that true of you and me? Do we count nothing as important as following Jesus? We have so many things in our lives. We have careers, we have families, we have aspirations of one sort or another. I wonder, do we follow Jesus wholeheartedly, as Paul did? Are we surprised when we face opposition? Do we think this is something that shouldn't be happening, despite Jesus' warning that it very likely will happen? Believers in many countries face that reality daily. They know that following Jesus may cost them everything. I wonder, are we a bit soft? Now, speak to me as well as to you. Speak to all of us. Do we expect our lives to be easy? We're comfortable, middle class, content. We know our salvation is secure. In a way, our salvation costs us nothing. Jesus paid the price. We've just been singing about his blood shed for us. And yet, following Jesus can cost us everything. Jesus never said it would be easy. And Paul certainly straightway gives us the example of one who's willing to follow Jesus courageously. It can mean swimming against the tide. When everything, being a Christian is often like that in society. When everyone seems to be going the other way, you probably heard the news this week of the surfer who was rescued, who was surfing off Scotland and was swept away out, and he just couldn't get back. The tide and the wind and the currents were against him, and he just couldn't get back to the beach where he left. Sometimes it's a bit like that being a Christian. The whole of society seems to be going the other way, and we need to be going against the current, against the tide, and it can be difficult, but that's what it means to courageously follow Jesus. Today, just as it did for Paul back in his day. And secondly, Paul confidently defends the gospel. Paul says, I'm here because of the resurrection. I'm here because of the resurrection. He knows that one day he will experience the resurrection himself. He says that in Philippians. And he says the resurrection of Jesus changes everything. That's what changes everything. That's what changed everything for Paul when he met the risen Jesus when he was on the road to Damascus. He met Jesus, the Jesus whom he had been totally against. He'd been persecuting the church. His life was completely turned upside down. He says writing to the Corinthians, Paul says this in 1 Corinthians chapter 15. Let me just see verses 13 and 14. If there is no resurrection of the dead, then not even Christ has been raised. And if Christ has not been raised, our preaching is useless, and so is your faith. And then he goes on, but Christ has indeed been raised from the dead. Paul says the resurrection changes everything. And he has confidence in that. He stands before the Sanhedrin, and he confidently says this, the Jesus whom you crucified is risen. And that's why I'm here today. That is the faith. That is why I'm on trial here today. I'm on trial because I'm a follower of the one who died and has risen again. That's the confidence that the gospel brings. Paul has met with Jesus, and he knows that despite the opposition, despite whatever may happen to him, there is no turning back. He is absolutely confident as he defends the gospel. The papers nowadays, and these days, are full of anti-aging strategies. I don't know if you've noticed them. Apparently, if you eat kale and broccoli and things like that, you probably live forever because they're the wonder foods at the moment. I remember, I've shown this to you before. Can you see it there? Yeah, just about. A number of years ago, I read in New Scientist, you probably read it in your copy. It says, down the bottom corner there, your chance to win life after death. Now, this was a competition where your body could be taken. I couldn't quite work out whether they wait till you're dead or not, but your body would be taken to California and frozen in liquid nitrogen until they found cures for all the ailments, and then you could be brought back to life and you would live forever, life after death. Many, many people in our world cling to the prize of life. We've been speaking about our life and the business and so on, and it's true, we are busy. But and life has a lot to offer us, but life will end. And life is flawed, and we know that life is sinful and is broken by the fall and by our rebellion against God. But Paul is absolutely certain one day we will go to be with him. That is what the resurrection means. The resurrection means that to us, and it's the message we have to take to the world out there. And so Paul confidently defends the resurrection. There are lots and lots of people who will deny the resurrection. Lots of people you talk to will say, oh, it couldn't really have happened. That doesn't happen, but it's the absolute key to our faith. Lord Darling, who was the Lord Chief Justice, said, in its favour, as living truth, there exists such overwhelming evidence, positive and negative, factual and circumstantial, that no intelligent jury in the world would fail to reach a verdict that the resurrection story is true. Someone who's used to looking at all the most difficult cases says, the resurrection, looking at the evidence, there is no other way to explain the growth of the church, to explain what happened to Jesus' body. The resurrection is the absolute key to our faith. Jesus died and rose again. Paul says that shows that he was the Son of God. He was descended from David, but he's proved to be the Son of God by rising from the dead. Peter says we have a living hope in the resurrection. That is what our faith is based on. And Paul defended that in the face of those who only a few short months after Jesus' death were denying that. Paul stands up and defends the gospel. And that's what we must do. In a world which wants to deny everything that we believe, we want to stand up and defend the gospel as Paul did. and just moving on quickly, Paul cleverly challenges his opponents. He knew his accusers. He knew that some of them were Pharisees. He knew that some of them were Sadducees. He knew that there were profound divisions. Verse 8 there. Paul, knowing that some of them were Sadducees and the others Pharisees, he says, I'm here because of my hope in the resurrection. And verse 8, the Sadducees say that there is no resurrection and that there are neither angels nor spirits, but the Pharisees acknowledge them all. He asserts the truth of the resurrection, and he knows that that's going to cause division because some of his accusers are Pharisees, as he was. Some of them are Sadducees. And he uses that very cleverly to divide them amongst themselves, and the whole row results, and eventually he has to be taken off and rescued again by the commander. You don't need to be an expert theologian to defend the gospel. You don't need to be an absolute expert. The key is knowing what the worldview of your opponents is. And knowing what people believe, knowing what people's view of Jesus is, of religion is, of your faith is, and knowing how to answer them, just having a few key points to answer them. It's quite difficult to just meet someone in the street like we did on May Day. It's quite difficult to engage with someone you've never met or you don't know, but maybe someone you know in your work or your college or your neighbours or relative, someone that you know what they believe and you know what their objections are. It's good to just be able to challenge them. There are lots of good books out there to help you. I've mentioned some of these before. If you have friends who take a very scientific view of the world, or if we've been singing about creation, but people who believe that everything evolved and so on, there's books like God's Undertaker or Gunning for God by John Lennox. Very, very good books, challenging books that you can read and learn what the arguments are and learn how to speak to some of those people, to ask them the questions. Searching Issues by Nicky Gumbel, another very good book. Distinctives by Vaughan Roberts, they're all out in the library there. Just do a bit of reading, find out what it is you believe. Another very good book there, Questioning Evangelism, over at the right-hand side by Randy Newman. Again, gives you little techniques for someone's challenging your faith, asking them the right questions to see what they believe, to cast doubt on their belief. And just while I'm passing this, thanks to Royce, who's invited Randy Newman over for the to speak at the, I think it's the June meeting of the C.S. Lewis program. Randy's going to come and speak here on the 18th of June. It's very, very unusual for us to get a big name speaker. I'm sure he wouldn't want me calling him that. But come along and invite a friend along. A real chance to hear someone who is used to defending the faith and can maybe give us some tips about how to do that. But don't be afraid to defend the faith. Don't be afraid to exploit the huge differences that there are between opponents. Many people will attack your faith, but they don't agree with one another. They don't agree with why the world is the way it is or how the world will ever be put right. We have the answer in our faith in the God who created us and who sent Jesus to redeem his world. So we need to challenge our opponents. We need to do it graciously and gently, but we need to know what we believe. Maybe that's a reason to get along to the C.S. Lewis series next year, to find out a bit more about your faith, to learn in depth, to be built up in your own faith, so that you can go and challenge those who would challenge your faith. And I'm sure Royce would be happy to speak to you at the end if you're interested in that. And finally, Paul completely trusts in God. Look at chapter 23, verse 11. The following night, the Lord stood near Paul and said, "Take courage. As you have testified about me in Jerusalem, so you must also testify in Rome." Paul knows that his defense doesn't rest on his knowledge or his clever ability to set the Sadducees against the Pharisees. It doesn't lie in the Roman judicial system, although he wasn't afraid to claim his rights as a Roman citizen when he had the opportunity. But God reassures him that as he has called him, he will go to Rome to speak on behalf of the Christian faith. You'll be my witness in Rome. And so this whole plot that is going on in the sidelines, that Paul hears about, this plot by the Jews to kill him, is thwarted. Because God has plans for Paul. God has plans for Paul to go to Rome, and he's not going to be thwarted by this plot hatched by some of the Jewish people. And so the commander organizes this huge guard for Paul, about half the garrison from the Roman garrison there, and organized for them to take him down to Caesarea. He says, a wee bit disingenuous in his message. It makes himself look the great hero that he discovered Paul was a Roman citizen, where he actually been about to have Paul flogged before he realized that. But what is happening is God is working through this Roman governor, Roman commander, to ensure that the message of the gospel gets to Rome. that Paul is going to get to Rome under arrest, but is going to get there to testify before the governors, and he'll speak to Felix and then Festus a couple of years later. God's plans won't be derailed by human schemes. There are so many ways in which the gospel is attacked today, so many philosophies and ideas, but God will protect his gospel and his people, and you and me, as we try to defend the faith that we hold so dear. Sometimes we think that Paul is a real superhero, that, you know, it's all right for him. You know, if I could just have been like Paul, if I could have spoken like Paul, then it would have been all right. But yeah, I'm hesitant and I'm timid. But Paul says, writing to the Corinthians, we read this in our home groups not very long ago, he said, "I came to you in weakness and fear and with much trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power." Maybe you think, you know, I'm not great at defending my faith. I'm not great in my work. I find it difficult in, you know, in college or in school when people seem to have opposite opinions. I just never sure what to say. Well, just remember those words of God spoke to Paul, that I will be there with you and you will be my witness in Rome. God wants us to be his witnesses. And it's good to learn about our faith, and it's good to learn the arguments, and it's good to learn how to defend ourselves, but ultimately we want to rely on God, just as Paul did, on the power of God's Spirit working through us. As we go out into a world where everyone seems to be swimming in the opposite direction, the current seems to be going the other direction, we need to have confidence in God. The church in these days was really in its infancy, growing amongst Jews and Gentiles, under attack then and now. The attacks on the church have never changed. But Jesus said, "I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it." Despite all the opposition, the church is still growing. And the task of spreading the gospel now falls to us, whether it's in the summer at the Holiday Bible Club or the football, whether it's out in your work or your college or your family. We still face the same enemy, but we still have the same God and the same Holy Spirit empowering us and equipping us to serve him. So we need to follow Paul's example, to serve Jesus courageously. Not to count the cost, not to worry when things go wrong, to defend the gospel, to know what the opposition is saying, and to try to have answers to counter those, but most of all, to trust completely in God. It's not up to you or me or our cleverness or our ability. It's up to God who's promised to build his church. Maybe you're here today and you're not even sure what it is to be a Christian. Well, if you want to find out more about what it means to be a follower of Jesus, then please come and speak to me or speak to Aaron or speak to one of us at the end of the service over a cup of tea or coffee. And if you'd like prayer for anything, then as always in the prayer room, out through the doors to my left, there'll be people there very happy to pray with you about anything at all in your life that is going on. But let's set ourselves that task of courageously following Jesus and defending the gospel. Defending the gospel of the one who died to give us life, just as Paul did. We're going to continue to follow Paul over the next few weeks and say we'll try and learn from him lessons that we can put into practice today. Right now we're going to sing our closing song, and we're going to sing "There's a Higher Throne Than All This World Has Known." In the midst of all our struggles, we remember that there's one who is above all of that, and who can empower us and equip us as his weak, sometimes hesitant, sometimes disobedient people to serve him in his word. So we're going to stand together and sing.